They're right on Capitol Hill. They're indoors. They're not the portable buildings that some have been saddled with in the past.
Staff for Senator Sullivan managed with temporary and tiny office space. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an earthquake boom.
From the Western Aleutians, southeast to northwest, Seward Peninsula, to the interior, all of these areas had quite significant earthquakes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you are a rural Alaskan knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in your region, please consider applying for one of the 35 seats on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Council meetings serve as a forum for regional public involvement in federal subsistence management. Apply by January 23, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, like other Republicans in Congress, is on a two-day retreat in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Speakers include former British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Jay Leno. Meanwhile, at his Washington office, APRN's Liz Ruskin interviewed Sullivan's chief of staff, Joe Balash, to get a status report.
To get to Sullivan's office, you go past the polished marble of the Senate office buildings and down to the basement, to a tunnel that connects two buildings. In the tunnel, across from a supply room next to a freight elevator, you'll find a doorway that leads to Sullivan's office suite. Four windowless rooms, some with cinder block walls.
I'm here to see Joe Balash.
Sure. Balash, who officially became chief of staff barely more than a week ago, says he's not bothered.
They're fine. They're right on Capitol Hill. They're indoors. They're not the portable buildings that some have been saddled with in the past.
The bunker-like rooms are just temporary, but it may be a while before they get out of that basement. In the Senate, a newbie can't just take the office vacated by his predecessor. A more senior senator might want it. That swap would leave a different office empty, and again, seniority determines who can call dibs. Sullivan is dead last in seniority, so he has to wait out a lot of office swaps. Balash says their moving day is months away.
Well, they've told us to expect to be here till June, but based on how long it took them to get computers, I would say it's probably more like August.
Ultimately, he expects to have 30 staffers in Washington, but it'll have to wait until after the move.
We just don't have enough desks here to fully round out the staff. So for now, we're going to be asking people to do more than one job, and that's okay.
The seven current staffers in the D.C. office do all have computers now. They have phones, and business cards are on the way. The official website is still a work in progress. Balash says they're waiting for software to handle data from constituent messages.
So that we can track and make sure we understand and are monitoring what it is people care about, what topics are hitting on particular news cycles, that sort of thing.
They've hired a legislative director, a top spot on a Senate staff. He is Peter Henry, who previously worked for Missouri senators. Balash says Henry has never been to Alaska.
We needed and recognized the need for a person to come into our leg director spot who is from the Senate, of the Senate, a creature of the Senate. And Peter's been working in the Senate for 10 years.
Balash, like the new senator, is a former state commissioner of natural resources. He has no congressional experience, so he says Henry is just what they needed. The other big hire is Amanda Coyne, co-founder of the Alaska Dispatch website and, until a few days ago, a popular blogger on Alaska politics. Coyne will be Sullivan's speechwriter and a senior advisor. Balash says Coyne can present a different perspective to the staff.
And in particular, what we were seeking was somebody who would prevent us from suffering from an echo chamber.
As he sees it, Coyne rode Sullivan hard in her blog on issues such as the Affordable Care Act, which she favors. Back in October, Coyne wrote that Sullivan displayed a fundamental lack of understanding of health care and didn't seem to care. Although, at other times, she had a lot of praise for the candidate, too. Balazs says she brings a lot to the position.
The big thing is Amanda is just a phenomenal writer, and bringing the communication skill set to bear on his job of communicating with Alaskans, with the public, is something that will help him do a better job.
He says Coyne will start in February. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks anticipates cutting between 200 and 250 jobs this year. That from UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers, who in an address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday focused on the effect of slumping oil prices on state funding for the university.
Our shortfall for the next fiscal year beginning July 1st is going to be somewhere between $20 and $30 million.
Rogers said about 40% of the UAF budget is state-funded, and the impact of the expected 7 to 10% reduction in state support will be widespread.
It's going to affect the people who deliver our classes. It's going to affect the research program at the university. It's going to affect how we recruit students, how we process financial aid. There's going to be no part of the university that is unaffected.
2015 UAF job cuts will be additional to 160 faculty and staff positions eliminated or not filled in 2014. Combined, the job cuts will amount to a 10% reduction in UAF's 4,000-member workforce. Rogers says the 2015 cuts will begin being rolled out next month following completion of a review of programs with low or declining enrollment and or low graduation rates. UAF non-academic programs, including sports and KUAC public broadcasting, are also being considered for reductions. The federal government says about 16,000 Alaskans have signed up for health insurance on healthcare.gov. That's about 3,000 more than signed up during the initial open enrollment period. More than half of the new enrollments are likely customers renewing plans. But Susan Johnson, the regional director of the Health and Human Services Department, calls the number huge.
We've almost doubled the numbers from last month to now, so it seems very strong to me. It's not a best-kept secret. I think the on-the-ground navigators and assisters are out and about doing work, and people are showing up and wanting to get covered.
Enroll Alaska is also pleased with the number of enrollees. Since the open enrollment period started November 15th, the company has signed up 1,300 Alaskans for health insurance. Operations manager Amy Crocker says about 75% of those enrollments are renewals. Crocker says the numbers would likely be higher if they weren't experiencing some glitches with how the federal government and the insurance carriers are processing enrollments. For example, she says a batch of enrollments from November didn't make it to the insurers until December 31st.
Right now, we're spending a lot of time administratively trying to make sure that the clients that we have assisted have their plans in place. We don't want to take on too much and not be able to help those people that we promised those services to.
Both Crocker and Susan Johnson expect the pace of enrollments to pick up as the deadline of February 15th approaches. After that, you can only sign up for health insurance if you have a big life change, like a new job. The federal government says more than 90% of Alaskans who have signed up for insurance on the exchange qualify for a subsidy. But Crocker says even customers whose coverage is subsidized have been affected by the large price increases for this year.
There has definitely been quite a bit of sticker shock and not understanding why that the rates have increased so much. And it's frustrating for people. People just want to be able to have access to something that they can afford.
Crocker says some customers have opted to pay the tax penalty instead, which for the 2014 tax year will be $95 or 1% of yearly income, whichever is higher. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, no snow delays the Tustamina 200 sled dog race.
To hedge our bets, we're going to give ourselves a couple more weeks to maybe let Mother Nature help us out a little bit.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Earthquake Information Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks logged more earthquakes in 2014 than in past years, a lot more. 40,000, an increase of about 10,000 from the average of the years before it. Michael West is the state seismologist at the center. He says part of the reason they counted more last year was because of better technology.
Better software, better processes, technological advancements. And this is the reason that back in the 70s we might have cataloged a few hundred earthquakes in a year, and now we're reporting tens of thousands. But on top of that, 2014 really was an anomalous year for earthquakes. Most all listeners in Alaska will note the strongest shaking that they had in a decade or so. This was true in Southeast with the earthquakes in July. This was true in the Anchorage area following the September earthquake in Skwentna. And this is true for the interior with the earthquakes in Minto. So all of these provided the strongest ground shaking in about a dozen years or so.
Where was the most activity? Were there areas that you saw consistent upticks in activity, or was it pretty much throughout the state?
There was the magnitude 7.9 earthquake in the Rat Islands on June 23rd. This was the largest earthquake in North America since the Denali Fault earthquake in 2002. That generated huge number of aftershocks. We expect them there. We expect earthquakes like this, even of that size. Other sequences caught us a little bit more by surprise. So, for example, the sequence of earthquakes in the Noatak region that unfolded in April, May, and into June, that doesn't happen very often.
Are there patterns or things that are different or changing in the areas where you're seeing quakes or their frequency that are of note?
Well, that's the great question in all of this is, are there patterns? Are there trends? And I think it's important to note that we have no reason to think that earthquake activity on the whole is on the rise or anything like this. It's the natural ebb and flow of the tectonics of the earth, as we say, the movement of the plates. And sometimes we will naturally have clusters of earthquakes. And I think that's what we had in 2014. So I would chalk it up really largely to coincidence.
That kind of naturally takes me to my next question, which is, there's been this commonly held thought that people have that if there are lots and lots of smaller earthquakes, and certainly fives and sixes are not small, but if there are a lot of earthquakes, it somehow takes the pressure off the fault line, and that's actually a good thing. Is there any merit in that?
From a scientific perspective, that's patently false. Small earthquakes don't release very much energy at all compared to the larger ones. They're basically negligible. Just for comparison, if we were to take all of the earthquakes in the United States over the past 50 years, every one of them, including the magnitude 7s and 8s in the Aleutians and the earthquakes in California and everywhere else, they would still be far less energy, about a third of the energy that was released in the 1964 earthquake in 1 4-minute period. So the point is, little earthquakes do nothing to alleviate the threat of larger earthquakes.
We're in the ring of fire.
We are.
Michael West is the state seismologist for the Earthquake Information Center at UAF. Nearly 8% of Alaskans walk to work. It's the highest rate in the nation, according to American Community Survey data. The national average is only 2.8%. But the state is also ranked number 3 for the rate of pedestrian deaths. 3 people have been killed in the past month. So what's happening in Anchorage to help keep walkers safe? KSKA's Ann Hillman found out.
Dressed in a heavy black jacket and dark pants, Keith Joe walks down Muldoon, headed from the bus stop to his trailer. He's not far from where a pedestrian was killed earlier this month, and where he says a friend's child was killed years before. It's a trip he makes nearly every day. He says he has one major complaint with drivers in the area.
They just don't remember to look the other way. They're just so worried about getting an opening in traffic that they pull out where they block you, and, you know, they just don't care. And or sometimes they'll even see you and they'll still pull out and because they just want to dive out.
Yeah.
And I just feel it's wrong. They're in a nice warm car and we're walking and it's cold. They could wait a second, you know?
But Joe admits that sometimes he breaks the rules too. He doesn't like having to trudge up the street to wait at crosswalks for the lights to eventually change. He says if traffic flow is low, he'll cut across the 5-lane wide street despite the risks.
Nighttime is most of the time when we will cross right here, but...
Even though then it's dark and people can't see you?
Yeah, we can see pretty good, so it's...
He shrugs off the question. State Department of Transportation data shows the number of pedestrian deaths in Alaska jumps erratically from year to year, but the trend is fairly steady, about 9 deaths per year. DOT traffic and safety engineer Scott Thomas says part of the problem is that pedestrians think they're visible when they're not.
You see the headlight on you and you go, well, I'm wearing brown. But to the motorist, that is dark, and it may be competing with the oncoming headlights of other cars.
Thomas says most pedestrian vehicle accidents happen in the fall when it's dark and roads are starting to get slippery. He says things are usually better in the winter because it's easier to see people with a white backdrop of snow, but not this year, where the grimy snow isn't helping visibility. So there's recently been a slight spike in pedestrian deaths, but the number of pedestrian accidents that result in serious injury has actually been slowly trending downward since 2000. Thomas says different design elements help. Crosswalk signals with timers reduce the number of accidents because pedestrians know how long they have to cross the street. He says medians, like the ones that we built on Muldoon this summer, also help.
If a pedestrian does try to cross in between an intersection or in between a signal, then there's a place of refuge, and it divides the crossing into two steps and makes it easier.
Anchorage traffic engineer Stephanie Mormillo says city code now requires all new road projects to include facilities for walkers and bikers, like sidewalks and bike lanes. She says the municipality is becoming more aware of different needs, mostly in response to community demand.
I guess there is a shift in the dynamic, I think, and a lot of people are really recognizing that, you know, roads are not just for vehicles. They are not. They are transportation corridors that provide for all users.
Mormillo says the struggle comes when trying to renovate old roads. They don't have the right-of-way to add more sidewalks or bike lanes.
When you're reconstructing these existing roads, you often have kind of a set limit, a set amount of space of what you really can do when you have all this development surrounding your roads.
She says they try to use as many innovative designs as possible to incorporate the needs of all types of users. But Mormillo says no matter how the road is designed, drivers, walkers, and bicyclists need to be aware of who's near them to keep everyone safe. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Anchorage could see a new tax on alcohol. A measure introduced in the Assembly last night will put the matter before voters this April. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Assembly Chairman Dick Traney introduced the proposal, which could use tax revenues to cover the municipality's costs connected with drinking.
So what we want to do is dedicate the fund stream then to police, to fire, to paramedics, to health and human services, because we have a severe alcohol problem in Anchorage. And we can't expect Juneau to bail us out of our problem in this town because they don't have the money to do it. We've got to tax ourselves to take care of the alcohol problem we have in this town.
Many specifics have yet to be figured out. For example, the tax rate itself is left blank in the proposal. The Assembly's Finance Committee will assess what revenues can be expected from a 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% rate. Traney also asked the Committee on Public Safety to discuss the measure, as well as a group tasked with looking into connections between homelessness and substance abuse.
We've got to have adequate health services, detox centers, because there's so many times where people say, hey, I want to get off alcohol. The problem is right now we don't have the beds for them. And you can't tell somebody, hey, come back next week or 2 weeks and see us again, because it never happens.
Traney says it's important for Anchorage voters to decide whether or not to adopt the law. Public testimony on the matter is scheduled for January 27th and February 3rd. Municipal elections are in April. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Environmental Protection Agency recently issued the first ever federal standards for the disposal of coal ash by electric utilities. The toxin-containing ash has gotten national attention in recent years due to spills in the lower 48. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the situation is different in Alaska.
The new regulations established coal ash landfill and surface impoundment requirements and were rolled out by Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy during a teleconference last month.
This is a gigantic step forward, and I am sure that our environmental constituents, as well as the utilities and the states, will appreciate that we are in a much more certain position today than we were yesterday, and frankly, we're making up for decades of uncertainty.
The new regulations cover landfill and impoundment location restrictions, structural integrity requirements, as well as environmental monitoring and contamination cleanup, but stop short of classifying coal ash as hazardous waste.
That would have been very bad for us.
That's Bucky Wright, president of Aurora Energy, which operates a coal-fired power plant in downtown Fairbanks. Wright says having to pay to dispose of coal ash would be much more expensive than what the company currently does with it.
Used as fill, usually a sub-base material for parking lots or driveways or under buildings. And so that's what's happening to ours now, and it has for quite some time, actually.
Six operating coal-fired power plants in the interior are estimated to produce about 100,000 tons of ash annually. And ash from a University of Alaska Fairbanks facility is also used as fill material. The disposal practice will continue to be allowed under the new EPA regulations, a disappointment to Pam Miller with Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Coal ash contains highly concentrated levels of heavy metals and should not be used in fill or other types of projects. It should be disposed of as hazardous.
An Alaska Community Action on Toxics 2011 report on interior coal ash found it to contain higher than background levels of heavy metals and mercury. The report warns of the danger of breathing in coal ash dust and of ash leaching toxins into groundwater. But Department of Environmental Conservation Solid Waste Program Manager Doug Butine says state testing backs regulation of coal ash as inert material.
Because leaching tests on the ash continue to show that none of those metals leach out in any significant quantities.
Butine says state tests also show no detectable quantities of mercury leaching from coal ash. Three of the interior's coal-fired power plants are on military bases, where ash is disposed of in landfills that aren't covered by the new EPA rules. Coal ash from a Golden Valley Electric Association power plant in Healy goes back into the nearby Usabelli coal mine. There's a new coal ash landfill on 80 acres in North Pole. Owner Jeff Day says he anticipated the EPA regulations and constructed the facility accordingly.
Designed it with a pit liner, collection basins, and monitoring wells.
Day says he planned the landfill to take coal ash from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
But they've decided to put it on their own facility, so just waiting for a customer.
A UAF spokesperson says the university opted to continue using coal ash as fill to save the cost of tipping fees at Day's landfill, but Day is optimistic the facility will someday serve its purpose.
Whether it's enforced on a federal level, state level, or somebody who will just become environmentally conscious enough to want to put this in a proper location.
The DEC's Butine says the state can develop its own coal ash regulations additional to those established by the federal government. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Wind, heavy rain, and temperatures at times nearing 50 degrees on the Kenai Peninsula mean the Tustamina 200 sled dog race won't be running February 7th as planned. And race coordinators aren't even confident it will run at all this year. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
In the winter, temperatures and conditions can vary drastically up and down the Kenai Peninsula, but this year it's been unseasonably warm across the board. There's some snow on the ground in parts of the Central Peninsula, but the Southern Peninsula near Homer is seeing rain, rain, and rain. Not good news for mushing. Tammy Murray is the race director for the Tustamina 200, which has been postponed until February 21st.
We are lacking snow, as everyone knows. We flew the course this past weekend, and definitely we're disappointed in what we saw. So to hedge our bets, we're going to give ourselves a couple more weeks to maybe let Mother Nature help us out a little bit.
Teams begin in Kasilof on the Central Peninsula and follow the rugged Caribou Hills to Homer in the south and then head back. During the flyover, Murray says she was very disappointed to see patches of green grass near the turnaround point of the race.
And that's where we're seeing the most trouble, is on the Homer side in the hills.
Regardless of whether or not conditions improve, the T200 can only be postponed for so long. Murray says the March 7th start of the Iditarod is a factor in the timing.
So 2 weeks prior to that is basically as close as the mushers want to be. They stopped their racing prior to the Iditarod, about 2 weeks out. And in a week earlier, it's a little tough because they're doing all their drop food bags for the Iditarod. And we've got a fair number of Iditarod mushers signed up for our race.
Similar conditions prevented the race from happening last year on its 30th anniversary. If it's canceled again, that milestone will have to wait to be marked until at least 2016. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.